This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Fracas. Fracas.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for March 9th, 2017. The Is This the Worst Bill in History edition. I am David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I'm obviously putting some color on our title today. Emily Bazelon.
The worst bill in history.
I know. I'm just okay. Setting it up. Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine is in yawn over there. Hello, Emily.
Hello.
And John Dickerson is with me here in D.C., host of Face the Nation. Hello.
Hi.
John's heading to Georgia this morning. He's going to Georgia. He has taken a midnight train to Georgia, also a mid-morning flight to Georgia. We had a ridiculously busy and pretty disheartening week. The world is moving too fast for us, but we're going to try. We're going to try to stay current. And we're going to do that by first talking on this week's Gabfest about Ryan Care, or possibly Trump Care, or maybe it's just Obamacare Light. It's here. Does the GOP's repeal and replace bill have a chance? Then President Trump's outrageous wiretapping charges against President Obama, and will anything come of them? And then the assault on Planned Parenthood. Will Planned Parenthood's federal funding survive the Obamacare bill, or will it survive the Trump presidency? Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter, and in Slate Plus, the fracas at Middlebury College involving controversial conservative scholar Charles Murray and some incredibly ill-behaved Middlebury College students. If you are not yet a Slate Plus member, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus. And don't forget, we have a live show here in Washington, D.C. at the Warner Theater on Wednesday, May the 10th. You can go to slate.com/live for more information. It's going to be for the Trump 100 days. I think I realized we had a live show in Los Angeles last week. The live shows are really fun. We love doing them.
Just realized that?
No, I didn't just realize it. I didn't just realize it, but it was really fun.
It was really
fun to do it. I love doing the live shows. I think we all love doing them. And so we hope you guys come out, and it's going to be a news action packed moment and time for a very interesting show. So join us at the Warner Theater on May 10th in DC, slate.com/live.
I have a quick question. Is fracas the right pronunciation? I thought
fracas.
Didn't we have exactly this kind of conversation on a show recently?
Yeah, fracas.
Yeah, about lugubrious maybe, but
yeah, that was definitional,
not pronunciational.
Yeah, this is how to pronounce it. I'm hesitate to question you because you usually know more about language than me, but I've never heard anyone say fracas before.
I've heard people say fracas over and over again. John?
I've heard people say both. I'm maintaining my traditional posture.
Intern Kevin is on the Google. He is confirming with a thumbs up, fracas.
But is it fracas and fracas? Is it fracas and fracas or just fracas?
Fracas. Wait, so Kevin's claim, which does not, unfortunately, is not going to stand up to scrutiny, is that the U.S. pronunciation is the Palatian fracas and the U.K. pronunciation is fracas.
Wow.
We're going to have a fracas here.
Grief.
I can't tell you how many times I heard just this kind of conversation when I was covering the Trump campaign this summer. I mean, it was a constant fracas, fracas.
This is not what the middle America wants to hear.
Oh, well.
Oh, well. A death panel of a bill was sent over from the House GOP to the country this week. It was had been kept hidden. The American Health, what is it? The American Health
Care Act.
Health Care Act had been kept hidden last week, and we can now see why. The Republicans will try to cram through a bill without the CBO scoring it before at least the committee's vote on it, without a huge amount of debate. They're going to try to cram it through because it is a dog of a bill. The bill to, I'm editorializing strongly here, but the bill to reform Obamacare would eliminate the individual mandate. It would eliminate a lot of taxes on the rich. The estimates are that the average person in the 0.1% will get a $200,000 tax break, and basically nobody else will get any tax break.
90% of the tax breaks go to the top 1% and 62% to the 0.1%.
Yes. It puts in a tax credit system to help people offset the cost of their health insurance, which will probably benefit younger people and make it incredibly hard for people, say 40 to 65, to get affordable health care insurance. Estimates are that somebody who is a low earner in his 60s may have to spend half of his income to get health insurance covered just to pay the premiums. That doesn't even whatever other copays you're going to have to pay.
And you also, did you mention that there's no clue about how the Republicans are planning to pay for the costs of the bill?
There's no clue about how it's going to be paid for because the individual mandate is gone, been replaced. The idea to keep people in the insurance market is there's some modest penalty. If you lose coverage and you want to get back on coverage, you have to pay a premium on your
30% surcharge for a year.
The fear actually is that that's going to speed up a death spiral because it's not that much of a penalty. People may just choose to stay out of the market until they get sick and then jump back in when they do, because the ban on discriminating on pre-existing conditions remains. It also delays the Xing out of the expanded Medicaid funding until 2020, which means that certain Republican governors who wanted to make sure that that funding for that remained are at least moderately happy that it would stay for a little while, but it's not going to stay forever.
And then it changes and the states have much more flexibility about Medicaid. And also, if you're not already signed up, you don't this whole confusing thing that basically limits the effectiveness of Medicaid and also would leave Medicaid recipients with bills that they currently don't pay.
So this bill is being attacked from the right for being too much like Obamacare, for being really too generous with health care benefits and really and creating a new entitlement in these form the form of these tax credits for poorer people, being attacked on the left for being too stingy and making it impossible for many, many people, particularly middle-aged and older people, to afford health insurance and put endangering insurance markets, being attacked in the middle because it's creating uncertainty in the market and taking away forms of insurance for people that people already have. And it's being attacked by everyone because there's also a provision in it which would provide tax breaks for high paid health insurance company executives, that's always a good one to put in there. Why is it such a terrible bill, Emily? Did it have to be so bad?
It's not
a terrible bill. Maybe you should rise in defense of it.
No, I can't rise in defense of this because it is a less generous and a kind of frayed, like a full of holes version of Obamacare. I'm not super fond of the phrase Obamacare light because light can be a good thing. It's like going on a diet. This is like Obamacare full of holes, I think. But if you're a purist conservative and you don't think the government should be expansively involved in healthcare, it doesn't have any intellectual coherence because it buys into the notion, the sort of philosophical underpinnings of Obamacare are all still there. It just like does a bad job of actually making a sturdy structure to support that. Yeah, so I'm not going to defend the bill. I mean, it takes care of the promise to repeal and replace or repeal and do something. And I guess that if you are a Paul Ryan style conservative and you think that making benefits more generous for people as you go down the income scale is something that discourages them from working, it addresses that because the tax credits aren't tied to income the way they were before. So you don't get more if you're poorer. But as a sort of intellectual enterprise, it would be much cleaner and defensible if the Republicans were simply giving a big tax cut. I just don't quite see how this like weird jerry-rigged contraption is going to be broadly defensible. And so far, nobody, I mean, it's been incredibly quiet, the defense of it. The insurance companies haven't come out against it, but the hospital associations have, doctors have, the nurses association, there's like, and they're both conservative and moderate Republicans who are speaking out against it. So yeah, I don't know. John, what do you think?
The big problem with this is that it's trying to do, it faces the same problem that the President Obama faced, which is that they're trying to squeeze a bill. It is not a perfect bill by the ideology of conservatives or by even what Paul Ryan would like, but they're trying to squeeze it through and serve a bunch of different masters. So one is that they have to move quickly because they made this promise to their voters that they would move quickly. They also have to deal with a promise that they're going to replace it, but they're not really replacing it. And they're pinched between these two different groups. So in the House, you have conservatives saying it's the Medicaid extension is essentially letting it last too long. Keeps that bad part of Obamacare, which they don't like. They don't like the tax credits. They think that's a new entitlement for poor people. And then on the, I guess you could say left, maybe not, but you have in the Senate, you have four Republican senators and probably more who think the Medicaid system in the new bill is not generous enough because there are a number of states and the four senators are from states where they took the Medicaid expansion. And you also have a number of governors in those Republican states that took the Medicaid expansion wanting off-ramp of Medicaid to be gentler and more sturdy than what's in the final form. You also have a slight problem here, too, which is that there was a leaked first bill and then there's this bill which came out. So there's a little bit of sorting and on this Medicaid question. But the problem is that Paul Ryan can't get his perfect bill passed because of all of these, you've got to pass it through reconciliation. So that's why it's a clumpy, ugly bill, because they're trying to kind of squeeze it in through this process. But the problem with that, it seems to me, is that you embed in the passage of the bill all kinds of flaws that are going to look bad down the road if things don't work out perfectly. And those flaws,
and you're going to own it. The Republicans will own it in a different way than they do the problems with Obamacare.
Yeah. Now, the argument that they make is that, of course, this is an alternative not to the perfect, but to Obamacare as it exists right now. So the two key questions, how many people does it cover and how much does it cost, right at the center of the legislation, are unknown for the purposes of debating it. That as a procedural process question is not sustainable. You can't... if you're going to do your job right, you have to know what it costs and how many people it covers. And you can argue reasons why somehow you can get around that. But just as a basic kind of thing, you need to know what the math looks like. And there's that problem. And now you've got Tom Cotton. So let's say it's a year from now and everything doesn't work out the way the authors of this plan would like. It doesn't seem that hard to imagine a critique that says, hey, it's not working because they rushed it through in this big, heated, fast process where they didn't even know how much it was going to cost and who was going to get covered. Even Tom Cotton, no shrinking liberal, said, hey, slow down, folks. And they didn't do it. That's a bad thing to have out there if the bill doesn't work perfectly. And guess what? It's not going to work perfectly. It's a huge, complicated thing, the American healthcare system, 18% of the economy. Doesn't always work out the way you want, and especially when you can't offer your perfect bill.
I think there's a fundamental threshold problem for the Republicans in this, and it's completely of their own making. The number one issue, as a friend of mine was pointing out to me this week, so I'm stealing his point. Republicans don't actually believe in healthcare as a kind of guaranteed benefit for Americans. You know, Trump has sort of put it out there and they've accepted like, oh, we're going to reform Obamacare so it's better. But ideologically, most conservatives actually don't think that if you're poor and you can't afford it, that you have a right to insurance. I mean, they just don't believe it. And therefore, they are trying to solve a problem where they don't believe this. They don't actually believe in the solution. That's an issue which just poisons everything that they do around this, because they don't have the courage of their convictions, which the Democrats did, because the Democrats actually do believe it. Second is, the fact is, there is Republican health care reform, and it's Obamacare. That Obamacare was basically a stolen Republican idea of how you do health care reform and manage to keep private markets. And the individual mandate is a Heritage idea, a Heritage Foundation idea Obama adopted. And so there was basically an adoption of a kind of conservative version of healthcare reform. Republicans, for entirely partisan reasons, came out in opposition to it and decided that it no longer conformed with their beliefs, but basically because they didn't want a president to have a victory over it. And now they're stuck. They're stuck because they don't have another coherent option against it, except one which nobody wants, which is to put everyone in health savings accounts and not guarantee anyone coverage at all. I have absolutely no sympathy for Republicans who made this bed by being so nihilistic about Obamacare, which was a bill that they should basically have endorsed.
Right. Matt Iglesias had a really good piece about this in Vox, I thought, about exactly what you're saying, that essentially the Republicans didn't make the case against a right to healthcare or against a government role in healthcare. And Trump made a case for, like, beautiful healthcare for everyone, better than you had before. So I'm really interested in the role that President Trump plays or doesn't play in selling this bill. I mean, he's come out in support of it, but I just found, I mean, here's what he said about it the other day. This will be a plan where you can choose your doctor. This will be a plan where you can choose your plan. And you know what the plan is. This is the plan. We're going to have a tremendous success. It's a complicated process, but actually it's very simple. It's called good healthcare. So, I mean, I guess
I'm clear. It's all clear now.
Right. Like, that passes, like, the car salesman test, I guess. But it's completely devoid of any kind of substance. It's like total empty air. And I just, you know, I don't know. Maybe, like, Trump's, the threats he can make and the way in which he can make Republicans in Congress afraid of his base, that saber rattling will have an effect on them. But you just think of, like, all of the work that President Obama did, all the muscle he put behind Obamacare, and then you compare it to that and you think, like, how is this going to work? And also, if this seems like it's starting to go down, is Trump really going to put the reputation and this is like the first legislative test of his presidency. Is he really going to put himself behind it? John, what do you think about that?
I think that's right. So the difference is between the president's power as a marketer when he was a candidate. Make America Great Again was the perfect distillation of his argument for his supporters. But now he has to come up with a perfect distillation of a piece of legislation, not just to win over people who are already with him, but for other people. So it's a different marketing strategy and a different marketing process.
Challenge.
And just saying it's going to be awesome is probably not enough. And it's also not enough armor when the inevitable churn that happens. I mean, this is the problem that President Obama faced when he claimed things for the bill that were going to be impossible to promises that were going to be impossible to keep. So when he said you can keep your health care, you can keep your doctor if you want, he knew at the time he was saying it was impossible. But what he hoped is that the bill would turn out in a way that people would not be bummed that they couldn't keep their old system because they were getting all this other new stuff. And so while I may not have the special features on my existing car, man, this new car I've got has so many other special features. I'm not going to sweat the thing that I've lost because I got all these other things. When the other things didn't make people feel good about losing their choice in the way they thought they had before, they got irritated and angry. And that feels like this is being set up in the same fashion when the president says you will be able to pick your doctor and pick your plan. I mean, I'm in the private healthcare market and I can't pick my doctor. So how is it in the public plan you're going to be able to pick your doctor?
John, so there's these two competing facts. The fact one is Republicans, the president, Paul Ryan, have made absolutely central to their political success the idea we are going to repeal and replace Obamacare. That has been the thing that has been said over and over again for the past 8 years. It is the number one message that they have conveyed to the world. Number two is there is the reality that there is a bill on the table, which not many people, no Democrat and not even that many Republicans seems to like, and is fraught with problems. Which of those two things appears to you to be more likely to prevail? Is there a bill that they can whip 218 votes and 51 votes for, or 50?
I think they can get their 218. And this goes back to Emily's point about salesmanship. And this is important because when you're selling just to muscle people because you have extraordinary power over the Republican base, great, you can get the 218. But the problem is, are the arguments that you use to get the Freedom Caucus, those Republicans who are extra conservative, who have problems with the bill, and you bring them over to the White House and they do some bowling, you can get them on board. But when you get them on board, is anything that you've, any argument that you've made a sustaining argument, or have you just basically just pressured them into doing it? If you've just pressured them into doing it, you get your bill, but you arm them with nothing that they can go out and then use to advocate for the bill when things start to get hairy. And things are going to get hairy because there's a lot of churn in this. There are going to be winners and losers. And to pretend that there aren't going to be losers is politically required and necessary, just as it was for President Obama. But it embeds a flaw in your day.
But so they can get 218. Can they get to 50?
So then the question is in the Senate. And this is where it gets interesting. And this is what Tom Cotton was talking about. You have both procedural resistance to what's happening in the House, and you have policy resistance. So you have procedural, you have Lindsey Graham saying, hey, don't give me a take it or leave it because I'll leave it. So don't force me, Mitch McConnell, to vote for this. Then you have policy issues that Susan Collins will not like the Planned Parenthood piece of this, as well as some of the specific provisions of the bill itself, probably the Medicaid provision. And then you have these four senators who wrote a letter saying that they wanted more generous treatment of Medicaid in the bill. Now, some of those senators are gettable, which is to say, part of what they're doing is they're acting as a counterbalance to the Freedom Caucus. So if the Freedom Caucus is the only one making noise in the House, then things are going to be done. That's the Freedom Caucus they're calling.
I don't think they've got Emily's number.
If the Freedom Caucus is the only group angry about the bill, then they're going to get all of the tweaks and tinkering that's going to make the bill better for them. So moderates or people in states where they want to keep the Medicaid expansion need to make noise, even if they're not going to make a final stand on that issue. And then you get into these really interesting questions about, do we start getting House versus Senate violence? And the president, does he start blaming the Senate? President Mitch McConnell are not palsy-wowsy. Paul Ryan will get pressure from his conservatives saying, hey, why don't you go tell Mitch McConnell to go jump in a lake? Go make Mitch McConnell do these things. It doesn't work that way. And then you have other interesting games going on, like Mike Pence, the vice president, will be in Louisville, Kentucky on Saturday campaigning for the bill. Rand Paul is an opponent of the American Health Care Act. A number of counties in Kentucky have benefited a lot from the Medicaid expansion. So I don't know how this plays out, but again, the process and how it goes forward, I think matters in the ultimate political calculation here. And already, by the way, the messiness of the process so far undermines a central claim of the last many years, which was that conservatives argued that Obamacare was such a disaster and that the solution to it was relatively simple, that it was pretty obvious how bad Obamacare was and that the right way to go was a relatively simple fix. We're seeing, obviously, as this goes forward, that it ain't so simple.
Emily, one of the consistent themes in Republican legislation over the past my lifetime is whatever the problem is, the solution is cutting taxes for the rich. So what the American Health Care Act is, above all, really more than anything else, is an enormous tax cut. It's a tax cut on investment income for wealthy people and on a Medicare surcharge tax also for wealthy people.
It's a total
people.
Of $600 billion, right?
And it's $600 billion in tax cuts, which, as you say, overwhelmingly go to America's richest people. And so most Americans will get $0 out of these tax cuts, and then we'll have to pay higher healthcare premiums. Why do you think there's been so cavalier about having to pay for this? I mean, essentially what's happened is these tax cuts mean that they have to cheap out on the bill, that they have to screw poor people and give them less in the way of healthcare coverage.
You're asking me why? I mean, that it seems like you answered the question.
Because I wasn't really. It was sort of a rhetorical question, but
right.
I hadn't talked for a long time.
So you like are pretending. Yeah. So, and the other thing that's just worth pointing out is that the people who seem the most disadvantaged by this bill are Trump voters. They're, you know, rural people are going to be worse affected than urban people because the bill severs the tie between how much of a subsidy or tax credit you get and how much the insurance plan actually costs. And the plans tend to cost more, I think, in rural areas. And then it is also going to hurt older people and people in that part of the income bracket, at least white people who tended to vote for Trump. So the politics of it are puzzling unless you think that people won't vote on this or they're going to get other kind of emotional benefits from it, to steal Arlie Hochschild's phrasing. As a political matter, it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense as a way of appealing to Trump's base.
The positive case that's made for this by its supporters is that by removing regulations, by deregulating, ending the minimum benefits, allowing interstate sale, repealing the mandate.
But they didn't end the minimum benefits, right?
They didn't end all of them. They ended some
of them. They kept a lot more than they seemed like they were.
Back to the argument for the case. Okay. The argument for it is that by removing these regulations and deregulating insurance, that you create market competition, that in those rural areas, for example, the rural hospitals that are closing like crazy because of the decrease in population in rural areas, that if they no longer have to, the insurance mandates in the Affordable Care Act and others, that those hospitals can survive. So that that under the Affordable Care Act, those hospitals were dying and going away, remove the regulations, they stay. And then the other positive case for this is that you remove those regulations, premiums drop, more people can get coverage. But this is what gets into your age shifting problem, is that the people who can get coverage and cheaper coverage tend to be the healthier ones. The problem is with the sicker older ones. And it's worth just going back to this individual mandate question and the replacement. The idea of replacing the individual mandate with a 30% penalty for not maintaining continuous coverage does seem to have a strange set of incentives, which is that if I'm a healthy invincible, you know, I'm not going to have health insurance, just as they didn't under Obamacare because they think they're invincible. And then when they're faced with a penalty for signing up, if you're healthy, why are you going to sign up before? What's the answer? Well, you might be sick. Okay, so now you've just found a way to encourage healthy people to stay out and sicker people to join in. And so now your risk pool is full of old sick people and the young sick people. I haven't heard a good explanation for why that isn't a real flaw.
Adverse selection. Ugh. All right, one last question. Emily, what is it that Democrats should do now?
Well, I think that, first of all, there's like a local regional difference in strategy. So in states or congressional districts where you could have a swell of opposition that would actually affect your representative, I think that advocacy groups should, you know, in order to realize their goals, should do that and probably will do that. The question, though, of like what Democrats in Congress and particularly the Senate should do, I think if I were them, I'd have a kind of wait and see attitude, because if the Republicans torpedo this on their own through their infighting, those are the best kinds of headlines for Democrats, right? I think that the Republican warring over this, if the narrative of this bill ends up being, well, the Republicans couldn't even agree on a solution after these 7 years of complaining about Obamacare, that's a pretty good campaign line to run on. Eventually, depending on what happens with this bill, there's a really interesting set of questions about Obamacare and how it's functioning or not functioning right now. You know, whether it would have all been great if Trump hadn't been elected and kind of called it into question and shaken the foundation, or whether it was just having problems that weren't going to right themselves without Trump in office. I don't know. But if this bill doesn't pass, then the Democrats, I think, need to get involved in proposing ways in which to make Obamacare stronger and sturdier. Because Obamacare this year, you know, the signups are somewhat down. It's possible that there are going to be more places in the country where there's no competition in the exchanges, et cetera. But I do think right now that the main play is not really the Democrats.
It's a good moment for them to grab, you know, quick, what do the Democrats believe in? You need people to be able to answer that question automatically. And this is a perfect place for Democrats to stage this fight is because it matters. People are paying attention. And Democrats have a history with this issue. Now, they have to kind of all agree on what they believe. But
so, John, is the question for them whether they say we believe in Obamacare, we want to make the Affordable Care Act better, or we want something that is, you know, single payer, like, right? Is that
I think what they say is what President Trump used to say privately before he got in the mix here, which is Obamacare can be fixed. So for Democrats, obviously, you want to hug President Obama and Obamacare. It's getting more popular. It's important with your base and so forth and so on. And then you just admit that it needs fixes, which even President Obama admitted several times. So it's a pretty simple, it seems to me, two-step in terms of hugging the thing that's popular in your party and then recognizing that it, of course, needs changes. I really, just looking at what Tom Cotton has said, Tom Cotton has just handed Democrats a pretty big gift because he has said in three tweets that came out on Thursday, he said to the House, pause, start it over, get it right, don't get it fast. GOP shouldn't act like Dems did on Obamacare. No excuse to release a bill Monday night. Start voting Wednesday with no budget estimate. And then his third tweet, what matters in the long run is better, more affordable health care for Americans, not House leaders' arbitrary legislative calendar. So in three tweets, he has said the House leaders are rushing it. They're not getting it right. He's compared it to Obamacare. And that's powerful because it's not, you know, in any of these debates that are so partisan, when somebody from the other side basically makes your argument for you, that's powerful for the opposition.
This episode of the Gabfest is brought to you by Aura Frames. Are you looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura Frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It is super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. Aura Frames, in the notes that I have here, says moms like Aura Frames. I'm here to tell you that is like the truest statement in the world. I gave my mother an Aura Frame. She absolutely loves it. She's also always hectoring me to keep adding new photos to her Aura Frame so that she's got great new photos every week. So think about giving your mother or grandmother or aunt or sister or friend an Aura Frame for Mother's Day. It was named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things. Aura Frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages. And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code GABFEST at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. On Saturday morning, when I was making some really great biscuits for my kids, President Trump accused President Obama of wiretapping him with two P's in Trump Tower during the campaign. Without evidence, without investigation, basing his claim apparently on maybe some conservative talk radio or in Breitbart, he accused his predecessor of what would have been possibly a crime, certainly an astonishing...
Oh, a crime. Let's go for crime.
Well, I think...
The president can't personally authorize wiretapping.
But if their administration is wiretapping, that might or might not be a crime. It depends.
But Trump said President Obama, yes, and called him a sick guy.
But yeah. David's point is that it could be a semantic difference. So that if the Justice Department that is in the Obama administration is wiretapping him, then yes, it's not actually the president himself, but it would be a semantic difference as opposed to if there's no wiretapping by anyone of any kind anywhere.
Yes. Anyway, but certainly, you know, could have been a crime, as Emily said. Then 30 minutes later, he tweeted about Arnold Schwarzenegger's ratings on The Apprentice. So, Emily, what would have been a crime? What was he accusing the president of, and how could it have been carried out? The point, just bracketing that by saying this is... There appears to be absolutely no evidence. This appears to be a totally spurious, trumped up charge made, you know, just to chaff the system as usual.
Right. So, well, let's sort of divide this in half in the way that I think maybe you and John were going. The accusation in its kind of full bloom was that President Obama had personally authorized a wiretap of Trump, you know, that the president was asking the FBI to listen in on Trump's phone calls. That was like the most obvious reading of what he said. And if the president was misusing the intelligence agencies in that way to try to get inside information about his political opponent or derail his campaign in some way, that would be Watergate. That would be epic. Now, as you said, we have zero evidence for that. We have evidence for the fact that there is an investigation going on. We know this by the intelligence agencies of potential ties between the Trump campaign and Russian intelligence officials. Then there are these like little shreds of evidence, which I essentially discredit, that there were applications to the FISA court for warrants to do some kind of surveillance in relation to that investigation. Those reports, the FISA part that I just said, come only from the British press. They started on this blog called Heat Street, then they moved to The Guardian and the BBC. The Washington Post and the New York Times have been trying for months to confirm these reports of these FISA warrants and applications, and they haven't been able to do so. So I don't see any reason to think that that's true.
And also that surveillance was of Russian banks, right? To investigate Russian banks. It wasn't a FISA warrant to go after Trump. It was to go after Russian banks who presumably may have been doing something shady with people associated with Trump.
Right. And that report about like the server and Trump Tower pinging back and forth with the Russian banks. Yes, you're absolutely right. So in any case, I mean, it seems like what's really going on here, who knows what's really going on here, but if there is something really going on here, I would say it's that when Trump is in a corner, when he feels attacked, he wants to have an enemy. That's his instinct. It's like, let's lash out at someone. There's a way in which he's much more comfortable lashing out in a way that he then positions himself as being a victim, right? So when he was running against Hillary Clinton, he had an obvious adversary. Then she was gone. He has used the press in that way in the last few weeks. And now he kind of was looking around for someone else, and he picked President Obama. And that seems like a pretty effective move to make with his base. His base is willing to believe, basically, I would imagine, anything of President Obama. And when I was casting about try to understand these tweets, I was looking at Breitbart, and Breitbart had these very sinister headlines about Obama. And it's a way of discrediting the whole investigation, whatever it does amount to, which is a real investigation. So I guess it has that utility. The problem, of course, is that it makes the president seem unhinged and like he's using his office as a mouthpiece for conspiracy theories. And I just can't see how that has an appeal beyond his core base.
So James Comey, the director of the FBI, whose FBI agents would have been tapping Donald Trump had there been a tap going on, has apparently denied this vehemently and has asked the Department of Justice internally to deny it, according to some reports. James Clapper, who is the head of the DNI under President Obama, has denied this was going on. Why? I mean, John,
yes.
Respond.
Yes. There's so many things to say. Comey, I think also it was reported, asked the White House to get the president to stop saying this, which is, you know, which is interesting because the White House had asked, tried to enlist Comey's help in getting him to knock down stories in the press about connections between the Russian efforts to meddle in the election and the Trump campaign. There's so much at issue here. Because we should also note that the president could be in a position to know this arguably better than anyone because he has access to the secret.
Yes, but he chose not to.
I understand. But my point is that when these first tweets came out.
Right. Maybe he knew something we don't.
It could have been the basis of his actual intelligence briefings. And he just let something slip. So there is a debate every time the president uses Twitter to distract or to say something that is new in the history of America to ignore it or to say, well, he's just trying to distract. But in this case, this is something new. We haven't seen this before. This is news in the sense that not only attacking his predecessor so fast and apparently on such flimsy information, but there was also the possibility that he had real information. So it's now a mess. No one at the White House will back up what their boss says. And by the way, if he had actual evidence, the real evidence of the kind that he is privy to, this could be solved in a second. And so anyway, the White House said, we're going to let the congressional investigating committees looking into Russia investigate this. People on the committee have no idea what the president really is talking about. But this is all going to get adjudicated. And then we will be able to conclude whether the president was just winging out this information, which is highly volatile, highly sensitive.
But we know he was just winging it out. We know that. We know we are basically 99% sure that he was winging it out. And this, to me, reminds me of all the voter fraud claims that he makes, where he you know, puts out these absolute lies, disgusting lies about voter fraud, making claims that there is massive criminal conspiracy happening in the country against him. It's chaff. It's this chaff. He chaffs the system all the time. I think we can hope that a congressional investigation is dispositive and says this did not happen and President Trump lied about it. I don't think it matters. I think there's no punishment unless Congress is willing to impeach him, unless his cabinet is willing to Article 25 him or 25th Amendment him. There's not really a consequence to this man continuing to spread disprovable lies.
There's a potential consequence in 2018 and 2020. I mean, that's
well, there are electoral consequences,
right?
Yeah.
I think
that's supposed to be how we
the system
address
works.
Such problems.
I also think that it does matter, and it has mattered so far in this young White House when the president is criticized by his own team or by institutions that are a little bit separate from the political cut and thrust. Now, a lot of people believe that part of the president's goal is to bring all external institutions, and some people would also say this is Vladimir Putin's goal, is to make all institutions partisan and thereby delegitimize them as just partisan operations. So that may happen by the time these rulings come out. And also, by the way, the committee chairmen who are in the same party are not, it's not going to be in their interest to make the president, it's not going to be in their interest to embarrass the president. So when these final reports get issued, perhaps they'll be so nuanced that there won't be this final moment. But what I was trying to do is just in terms of classifying the different kinds of behavior of the president, we've seen in situations in which he's made incendiary claims, as you say, the voter fraud, and they have kind of just piddled away,
fizzled.
You know, and fizzled. And this case, he has inserted it into a process now, which makes it, just in terms of classifying the behavior that's happened in this administration, this is a new kind of thing and has happened in a new and different way. This now is a question that lives on in the committees and also lives on in the clumsy way that the White House is handling it, sort of saying, well, this is a view the president holds. And then when you have no one else at the White House who maintains or holds the same view and the FBI director doesn't hold it, that is different than in some of his previous claims he's made.
Can we talk also about the Justice Department and Comey and the Justice Department and Trump? So I think since our last show, Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, made the decision to recuse himself from the Russia investigations, which I think was a really important moment for rule of law in the United States of America. You know, Sessions did this apparently even though the president did not want him to pull himself out of the investigation and did it, Sessions said, after consulting with the career people at the Justice Department. I found all of that to be reassuring. I'm not sure what to think about the Justice Department refusing to refute the president. I kind of think that if Comey wants to refute the president, we know that Comey is willing to make public statements. He certainly did that about Hillary Clinton's emails. I'm not sure why he thinks he can't do that again. I guess to be generous to him, you could argue that he saw that that had problems and decided not to make that same kind of intervention. But there is some kind of like weird dynamic going on here. And the other thing I've been wondering about, you know, if this isn't merely incompetence, it certainly has like lots of incompetence in it. But if there's something strategic here, it is about discrediting information generally, which is like a project of the Trump administration. And then also the intelligence agencies, which Trump has attacked. And so what I worry about is that whatever conclusion this investigation reaches is going to have less of a hold with at least Trump supporters than it would have absent all of this like chaff, as you put it. And that's the way in which I think it actually matters. But then on the third hand, the idea that the intelligence agencies and their leaking of secrets as a way of being a check and balance on the presidency, the idea that like they're resorting to that is a bad sign. I mean, it's like a It's better than, you know, no checks and balances for sure, but it's not really a sign that like the system is in a healthy state, that that's where we're
right.
at.
Right. That's a great point. And also your point, Emily, about discrediting of information. I think we also see that on the healthcare bill with this yes. attempt to impugn the CBO and say, oh, the CBO is not reliable. We can't trust their projections, their estimates of costs. And it is, and we see it through the EPA and through what's going on in the agencies is this opposition or this willingness to discredit government information.
Credibility does at some point matter in presidencies. And so what the president did in his tweet is he said he had proof of something. And now he's asking for the Congressional Investigating Committees to find proof. That's another disconnect at play here. But the president has yet to face a crisis. And in all these things we've been talking about, there will become a moment where the things that the president says will matter in a really important way. And credibility is necessary for those kinds of moments. And these blows to credibility over time mount and then give you less in important moments. Or if your instinct is to say things that you can't back up, in an important moment, people tend to get a little bit more irritated. They don't perhaps write it off as just another sort of fixation of the media in their effort to knock down Donald Trump, but they can quickly see it as something that's dangerous.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
Among the many interesting features of the Ryan Care, Trump Care bill is a systematic attack on, attack is maybe a strong word, but Emily will endorse on women's health and reproductive rights. This primarily takes two forms in the bill. First, the bill would bar any federal tax credits being used on any insurance policy that provides abortion coverage. So that would effectively eliminate those policies from the market, because no one who's getting tax credits would buy some policy with abortion coverage because they wouldn't get the tax credit for it. And therefore, policies with abortion coverage are not going to be offered. Second, it would bar Medicaid reimbursement. I think I'm right about this, Emily. Bar Medicaid reimbursement for any health provider that also provides abortion services. Notably, this would hit Planned Parenthood. And here it is, of course, important to note that Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers are not getting public funding, any federal funding for their abortion services, except in very extremely rare cases. They are providing other forms of health coverage for which they're reimbursed, including contraception, cancer screening, STD treatments, et cetera. And this would deny them the Medicaid funding for that coverage that they were providing to people on Medicaid. This is, you know, fulfills a strong ideal of social conservatives to go after Planned Parenthood and go after abortion providers. Is it a non-starter, Emily?
Well, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski are very nervous about it. So maybe, probably. On the other hand, it's been something that a lot of Republicans have pushed and talked about as a priority for a long time. So I don't think we can assume that it's not going anywhere. To give a little more detail, so I think about 40% of Planned Parenthood's budget comes from the kind of reimbursement for non-abortion medical services you were just talking about. So the idea of Planned Parenthood losing that funding is a really big deal. It's a really big deal for low-income women who get their health care from Planned Parenthood. And then
one in five American women, I think, have used Planned Parenthood services.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a low-income woman, but I've used Planned Parenthood. I mean, Planned Parenthood is a big provider, and it has a philosophy of comprehensive women's health care, of which abortion is a relatively small part, but a part to which Planned Parenthood is committed. And so to take a step back from this, I guess we should also add that there was this kind of false olive branch extended to Planned Parenthood. Oh, well, if you stop providing abortion services, then you can keep your money. And then the president said some weird thing about how we'll give you more money, as if he didn't understand that this was all reimbursement for services and there is no more money unless you serve more women. And so that idea that Planned Parenthood could just step away from providing abortion. So, you know, in the past, Planned Parenthood has pointed out over and over again that something like 90% of its procedures are for services other than abortion. And so then I think that makes it tempting to think like, okay, well, maybe Planned Parenthood could just stop providing abortions and other clinics could do it and like, okay. And the problem with that, of course, is that for decades, really since the 70s, we've had this problem of abortion services being segregated and stigmatized and made less socially acceptable and less safe because they take place in these separate abortion clinics. I mean, just think of the Planned Parenthood building in your neighborhood if you have one. The one in my neighborhood is like a fortress because of abortion. There are also abortions going on at hospitals in my city that nobody really talks about. And oh, by the way, you know, the Republicans aren't talking about defunding hospitals because they provide abortion care. But the more and more the sort of move to separate abortion, it can seem kind of neutral on its face, but it's really not. It really is about preventing access to abortion and having fewer abortions and making abortion a more and more kind of like bad stepchild part of the healthcare system. Wait. as opposed to just like part of the course of healthcare. I mean, you know, I'm sure I've said this a million times on the show, but a third of women of childbearing age have had abortions.
Wait, Emily, actually, quick question there. I didn't even think about this. Hospitals do abortions. Many hospitals do abortions. This HCA, how does it only target Planned Parenthood and not hit the hospitals?
It has some provision in it where it's like a certain percentage of your budget comes from this. There have been court cases about defunding Planned Parenthood in the state. So they couldn't just say we're defunding Planned Parenthood. And so they wrote a sentence that basically only applies to Planned Parenthood based on the, I think, percentage of, yeah. Anyway, but right, if they were being consistent about this, they would also be defunding hospitals that provide abortion care. And of course, that's never going to happen.
John, is there a sense among Republicans as a political matter that this kind of attack on Planned Parenthood is a win, or is it just necessary base maintenance? Because I would have thought, I can't imagine. I mean, maybe they just figure the women who go to Planned Parenthood are just not going to be their voters. That single women don't vote for Republicans. Like, screw it. Who cares?
I think as I was talking to a Republican senator last night about these issues, somebody, it was in a context of the Senate campaigns coming up. And this senator was arguing that the political way this works in their view anyway, is that, so there's the base demands for sure. But then there is a worry for any Republican in a state where you have a sizable suburban Republican women population, where you don't want to look so doctrinaire that you are unreasonable, because then these issues have a kind of electricity to them that if you look like you're not reasonable at all, that you don't recognize, say, for example, that Planned Parenthood provides a variety of different kinds of services. And so that you have to, and this is true also on immigration, that you can be for strong borders and American laws, but kicking out families and the 11 million, you know, goes too far. So if that's true, then the politics of this can get dicey if you look like you aren't attentive to the larger issues of women's reproductive rights. I think the response to that from any Republican who believes in that theory would be maybe not to knock this down, but to take other positions that would signal to those voters that you have a more expansive view, say on something like over-the-counter
medical abortion?
Over-the-counter abortion drugs.
No. Over-the-counter contraception. Sorry, I was having two split thoughts at the same time.
Wait, over-the-counter contraception, like condoms in the drugstore, which we already have.
No. I think don't you have to get some prescriptions for other kinds of contraception?
Yeah, totally.
So I wasn't just being set up as a total idiot.
I mean, we should note, incidentally, that if you got rid of Planned Parenthood and you got rid of the general sort of care that women are getting from Planned Parenthood, the estimates are there'd be a huge number more unwanted pregnancies and a huge number more of abortions, ultimately.
Well, so, and also you just have 900,000 healthcare.
Yeah, and, yeah.
And a lot more costs because you have less healthcare.
The,
right. So, and actually, Texas did this. Sorry, I have this one more detail to add, which is that Texas tried to defund Planned Parenthood in this kind of way. And I think the estimate was something like 30,000 women lost their health care. And Texas then backed away from this kind of experiment. It's another, I mean, we have examples of that in the immigration domain too, where we had this like super strict immigration law in Alabama and it didn't work. So there have been really conservative states that have tried some of this and it has fallout.
I presume they're definitely going to keep, I mean, assume this bill gets through, they'll keep this, the abortion ban and the tax credits, like the not being able to buy
the private insurance.
Being able to buy, that'll stay. I presume that the Planned Parenthood stuff will come out, that they're not going to keep that in there. Ultimately, they'll concede on that.
Well, they'll trade that for Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski's votes. Yeah, I think that's probably true. So, and this I just
and also they still have Planned Parenthood to beat up on. They'll keep Planned Parenthood to beat up on, which everyone wants.
Right. Well, we should also mention Planned Parenthood is popular. I mean, that's been a saving grace for Planned Parenthood, is that polls show that most people don't think defunding Planned Parenthood is a good idea.
Yeah. It's also why I think ultimately they won't even defund the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, that it's actually good to have somebody to kick, that they're very easy, convenient things to kick. So
what about the National Endowments for the Arts and Humanities? And isn't NPR also on the chopping block? Do you think
NPR
all
is corporation?
Like,
NPR is Corporation for Public
Broadcasting.
It's just through a pass through. I think some of those will survive. I'm not sure if all of them will survive. Planned Parenthood, NPR, PBS, those are all things that are fun for conservatives to beat up on as wasteful government spending. So it doesn't cost very much to keep them around and you get to beat up on them. So that, I think it's easily worth it if you're a Republican to have Planned Parenthood to beat up on.
I don't know if you live, but by the same token, that all reverses on you when you can't get rid of them. You're in power, you own, but you know, you have control of both the House and the Senate and the presidency, and you can't get rid of these things. They have a huge, you can't, because then you can't say, look, they're really not worth very much money and it's not going to get us the savings we kind of need. And we need to husband our capital for passing premium support plan for Medicare. So let's put our political capital behind that big important thing and not these little things. I think it has costs if you don't finally get rid of the stuff you've been saying you want to get rid of for years.
Well,
don't we see this kind of centrist pull going on? I mean, what's to stop the Republicans except like themselves, except the voters and the polls, in some sense that parts of their agenda are just not politically feasible. I think the jury's still out on how much that's actually going to hold true, but it is quite curious.
Let's go to cocktail chatter when you're having a bubble tea with your loved ones, as I was doing during the show. What will you be chattering about, Emily?
Well, John wanted us to talk for a second about the transgender right to bathroom access case in schools. He prompted this chatter from me. Maybe he's lost interest in this by now because that was early in the week. But I, as always, dutifully just want to kind of let people know where
there's
the stance.
One adjective for Emily Bazelon, it might be dutiful.
It's dutiful. It's true. It's like my fundamental flaw, actually. But whatever, let's not go there. So Gavin Grimm, he is a student in Virginia. He has brought this case challenging his school district's refusal to let him use the bathroom of his choice. He's a transgender student. The Supreme Court was supposed to hear his case at the end of March and will not do so. And the reason the court sent this case back to the lower courts for reconsideration is, of course, that the Justice Department and the Department of Education withdrew their instructions to schools to let transgender students choose bathrooms. So now the lower courts have a much harder question. They can't rely on the federal government's reinterpretation of Title IX. They have to like look at Title IX for themselves. They also could potentially look at the Equal Protection Clause in the Constitution. And that's just going to be a harder case for Gavin Grimm to win. we'll see what happens. In the meantime, what this means for students is that schools, it's up to schools to decide where they use the bathroom. And that was actually already the case because a court had put a stay on the government's national order. But, you know, essentially we're seeing a kind of delay, a hitting of the pause button on a national right to bathroom access for transgender kids, which for some of those kids is going to impose real hardship, but it also could give the country a chance to think through and debate this more in a way that I think the Obama administration's order was a bit abrupt for some parts of the country. So anyway, that's one to watch.
JD, what is your chatter?
I have two chatter, well, maybe even three chatters. First of all, one thing that we didn't talk about in healthcare, but that happened is Tom Price on Sunday, on all places face the nation, basically said about Medicare that, you know, they're going to protect retirees and then they've got to shore up the system. And the reason that matters is that it was a question about whether the president was going to keep his commitment to not meddle with Medicare. Price has just broken that commitment. When you talk about shoring up and saving the system, that's what you say before you do a bunch of reforms to save it. Like, nobody noticed that. It was a big deal.
Also, they're going to shore up the system by taking away the Medicare tax, the extra premium, which
it was a part of the
Affordable Care Act that rich people are paying.
That'll shore it up.
We're going to shore it up by getting rid of the trust fund.
You know, this was a big struggle between President Trump, who had promised not to meddle it, and his various advisors who had reasserted that claim over time. It's a big change because that's where the big money is in terms of trying to fund the other stuff that Donald Trump wants to do. And it's also something that Paul Ryan has been focused on because he wants to get at long-term health inflation and its effect on the budget. And so this is happening. And the fact that it kind of didn't get that much coverage is interesting. Another big thing that's happening that's perhaps happening under the radar, though certainly not under the radar of ISIS, is that ISIS is about to be routed from Mosul. And there are now Marines that have just arrived in Raqqa in Syria to fire artillery shells. The end of ISIS's goal for a caliphate. And apparently al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, is on the run, has just basically left his diehards to defend. And he's off in the desert somewhere trying to save his own hide. Remember, ISIS was different from al-Qaeda in that it was going to have a geographical ownership. And they are now on the edge of basically losing that geographical ownership, which is a huge development. But it's also a nervous-making development for people who watch terrorism, because the response to that will be for people who align themselves with ISIS will be to try to strike back, to show that they're not losing this, their central goal of building a caliphate, which means, you know, that could anywhere that somebody feels the sympathies could be newly engaged. So while the travel ban is one way of talking about terrorism, there is this other much more volatile way of talking about it that's not maybe gaining as much coverage as it should.
Wait, was that two or three? Are you going to do a third chatter?
Well, no, because I think that's a little... I was going to tell people to go sign up for the Face the Nation Diary, which has relaunched with a weekly recap, because there's so much stuff that happens in American politics that we have now... using a model, an old CBS model with...
A diary.
Yeah, exactly. A diary of the week's events.
Do you start it by saying, dear diary?
No, although I suppose we could. But
if I was going to read
am I normal?
Anyone's diary, it would be yours, John.
Oh, really?
No,
I don't think there'd be
it actually is not that
salacious secrets in it. I would like a diary with salacious secrets.
It's also the same thing over and over again for years and years and years.
But you're trying to get people to sign up for the Face the Nation diary.
Well, that's different. That's a different diary.
What I meant.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you meant my personal diary.
Pro your sign up.
Yeah. No, thank you.
You've now undermined yourself.
Yes. No. Be pro sign up. Just don't read my actual diaries.
No. That's fine.
All right. My chatter. I'm gonna do two. Amid so much gruesome news, you have to keep track of some of the small crimes being committed in our name. And there was one this week that I found just disturbing and sad and pointless. The EPA, which is now being run by EPA hater Scott Pruitt, it wants to defund itself. It wants to do less and less. It wants to get rid of most of its programs or lots of its programs. And one thing it is proposing to get rid of is something called the Energy Star program. The Energy Star program is an entirely voluntary program, which allows the government kind of keeps an eye on and administers and spends some millions of dollars, some small number of millions of dollars every year to administer, which allows appliance manufacturers essentially to certify that their new appliances meet certain standards of efficiency. and this makes those appliances more valuable in the marketplace. It's a label that appliance manufacturers can put on their goods, and people will buy them and pay a premium for them. It saved, by one estimate, it has saved $430 billion in energy costs. It has avoided it has prevented a vast amount of emissions. It has encouraged efficiency. It has stopped waste and abuse. It helps literally everyone who touches it. There's no person who does not benefit from this, except the utility executives who want there to be more power used wastefully. Like, efficiency, energy efficiency is one of these pure goods. There's no possible reason to be opposed to it. Keeps more energy available for us for the future. It despoils the environment less, saves you money. Like, what possible reason is there to oppose it? And now Scott Pruitt wants to zero out the Energy Star program. Oh, also, it's voluntary. It's not even something which the government is imposing on people. It's entirely voluntary. It is just it's a pointless, stupid
So what you're saying is
thing to do. It's obscene.
David's a fan. We've
anyway,
established that.
My second quick chatter is just a self-serving one, which is all my self chatters are self-serving, is Atlas Obscura, as you know, my wonderful company. We need a controller. We need someone to help us with accounting and finances.
You're totally out of control.
Yes, someone to control me. We are a fast growing startup, and we need someone who really, like, you know, relishes the chance to help bring financial management to us and grow with the company. So if you're interested, if you're someone who thinks you'd be a great controller for a great startup, contact me at david@atlasobscura.com.
Isn't a controller a thing that you get elected to be? Isn't that a funny?
Well, that's
word?
A, you can also get elected to it.
The comptroller.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And never, by the way, is it controller or are controllers and comptrollers the same thing?
I think
thing?
They're the same, but we spell it with a C-O-N-T, not a C-O-M-P, but I think it's the same thing. I think it's the same.
Okay, that is confusing, and someone needs to go figure it out and let us know the answer.
It's the person who does financial management, accounting, you know, keeps an eye on the books for something.
Not to be confused with a librarian.
Or a financial manager?
Anyway. Our intern is Kevin Townsend. Our producer is Jocelyn Franks. Franks. You're not Jocelyn Franks. You're Jocelyn Frank, Jocelyn. If only there were two of you, then there would be Jocelyn's Frank.
Right. And if
really
they were...
Really confusing.
Emily, is it true that the Attorney General is called General? You call the Attorney
yeah.
General General
and
Holder?
Also some, or
General
yes.
Sessions? Solicitor General, too?
I think so.
Steve Lickteig is the executive producer of Slate Podcast. We call him Producer Lickteig. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer for Panoply. We probably call him General Bowers.
Chief.
Hey, Chief. The GabFest is part of the Panoply Network. We're at panoply.fm for all our podcasts there. Our show page is slate.com/GabFest. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/GabFest. Twitter feed is @SlateGabFest. And our email address is gabfest@slate.com. Please remember, we've got a DC show on May 10th. Wednesday, May 10th. Go to slate.com/live to get tickets. We'd love to see you there. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We'll talk to you next week.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.